Welcome to the Rooster Crows podcast. My name is Stephen Milton, and today we are talking about the Sistine Chapel. That extraordinary artistic masterpiece which can be found within the Vatican. It was painted by Michelangelo in the 1500s on the ceiling as well as on the altar wall, portraying absolutely iconic images of the Bible, but surprisingly often breaking away from the Bible to do so. We're going to be talking about the Sistine Chapel by having a discussion with author Jeannie Marshall, a Canadian who has spent 20 years in Rome and has a very personal and sometimes fraught relationship with the Sistine Chapel.
So my name is Jeannie Marshall, and I am a writer. I'm a Canadian writer. And I often say that just because I've spent the last 22 years living in Italy. And so suddenly nationality becomes very important. But before that, I worked as a journalist in Canada for the National Post for quite a while until I guess it was the early 2000s. So from when the paper started to the early 2000s.
Well, you moved to Rome. And in Rome, in your book, you say that, you know, you visited everywhere in Rome except the Sistine Chapel for, I think, what, 12 years or so. Why were you holding back on the Sistine Chapel in particular, since that's such an obvious, you know, tourist destination for anybody who's new to Rome?
I know. Like, I sometimes think if I had only just been going to Rome for 2 weeks, I probably would have gone to the Sistine Chapel. But it's one of those things you can put off, and people put it off. And I've talked to other people who live there. You know, we tend to put it off simply because it's always busy. It's always crowded. It's always a little bit difficult to get inside. It's not a big place, as you know. It's like when you go inside and you realize there's this place with this massive reputation, and it is enormous and high, you know, high up from the floor. It is a big thing, but you can't, it's not museum big in that sense. So no matter what, there's going to be very few times that you're actually going to be able to go and not have a lot of people. And so living in a place like Rome, where there are a lot of tourists, and sometimes when you're just doing your normal daily activities, like going to the market, you can become a bit exhausted by that. And so to actually put yourself in that situation is a little bit daunting. So that was one reason for sure. And then another reason I had to acknowledge as I started going was that my mother had a real reluctance and a real kind of complicated relationship with Catholicism, and the Sistine Chapel being this huge symbol of Catholicism. I think that was partly why I just didn't know what was wrong. I had a sense there was something possibly scary in there, and I didn't know what it was. Not that I had acknowledged any of that, but after going, I came to see that that was what was there.
And so eventually you do decide to go visit the chapel. And what was your impression the first time you walked in?
Yeah, it's interesting. I do remember going, and it was almost secretive. You know, I went and I booked a ticket online. My son was at school. My husband was at work. And I just sort of, you know, slipped away and went into the Sistine Chapel and just thought, well, just see, you know, what is it like? And certainly the museum itself, you have to walk through this huge museum, which is filled with unbelievably incredible things that I still love to go. I tend to spend too much time in the Sistine Chapel, and I still love to stop every now and again and just go and visit something else and in this amazing place. So I walked through all of that, and I was pretty tired by the time I actually got to the Sistine Chapel, stepped inside. And then I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to look, and I didn't know what I should be looking at. I had read about it somewhat, but seeing it is something else. Because when you read about it, you often look at panels and pieces and individual pieces. And I look and I think, I don't see any of it. I can't find anything familiar. You know, and then I found, of course, God and Adam in the center. And that's a kind of a way of grounding yourself. But the first couple of times, it was just more had the sense of being jostled around, being unsure what I was there to see. And I really observed other people, because I wondered, what are they here to see? what are we all doing here? I was sure that many other people were as confused as I was. Certainly the people, well, there are, you often meet academics there, historians, art historians, and they know better what they're looking at. And the tour guides, they know, they tour guides, I mean, they're amazing. They have been in that place so much and examined every little bit of it. So I started to realize there's those who know a lot about the details of it. And then there are the rest of us out here kind of, knowing that we should be here, knowing we should be looking at it and not really sure why. And so that became my mission to try to figure that out. Why? What is that? What is the answer to that?
And you mentioned that your mother was a sort of conflicted Catholic. are you any kind of Catholic?
I would say, I've met a lot of Jewish people who call themselves culturally Jewish, and then I thought, well, maybe I'm culturally Catholic. Maybe that's what that is. But I grew up with all of these. Well, I grew up with the fraught sense of Catholicism from my mother, but I actually grew up with a kind of lovely sense of it from my grandmother, because to her faith was very, very strong, and she had many images that you see in Catholic homes. The images of Christ on the cross, and she would, hold her rosary beads, and she would pray, and I didn't really understand it because I didn't see my mother behaving quite in the same way, but I did recognize that this was a kind of power that my grandmother had. It gave her a huge amount of strength, and she didn't have an easy life, and so I think it was something that was very important to her. But I
There's
didn't know how I fit into that. I still don't, to be honest.
So it sounds like you in the book you talk about how you were sort of dragged to Sunday schools and every kind of church except the Catholic Church. So you knew something about the Bible stories that were being depicted on the Sistine Chapel ceiling as well as its walls, right?
Yes. In fact, I loved the Bible stories. I loved going. I used to go by myself. My mom said I could take the buses that would come in our small town and take you to whatever church, but it was just don't go near the Catholic church. Just don't go there. Okay. But I went to all these churches, and you'd sit in, someone would tell you a story. You'd sit in small groups or big groups, and I can still remember my first experience of hearing some of them as well, and that they were just these incredible stories, unresolved stories, things that had mystery and no clear answers, which is I think when you're a child, you're kind of looking for answers, but you're also willing to grapple with that kind of ambiguity. So I loved all of that. And then later, when I became a literature student at university, of course, then I saw the effect of Bible stories on literature in the Western world, and I thought, oh, lucky me that I have actually encountered these stories before. So that was great. That was kind of nice.
But it sounds like from the book you walk into the Sistine Chapel not as a self-identified Christian, right?
No, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, definitely someone who's resistant and skeptical. Of not of God or of, I mean, I don't know what I'm skeptical. I'm a very confused person, but I think when I walked in, I'm not going in as a person of faith. I'm not going in as a believer, but I am going in as someone who believes that this object, this place is very important to the Western world, maybe to the world in general. And I was also very interested in the fact that Michelangelo himself was quite devout. And so his faith obviously is going to make a big difference to the way we experience the work that he creates. And I was interested in that. I think sometimes that, there's so much cynicism in art of our century that to encounter something that's done in all sincerity like that can be really powerful. And so I went in with that interest, but not a fellow feeling, I suppose, is the way to
Right.
put it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I went. I've been to Rome twice, and I was there for the second time this summer. And I'm a minister, so of course I'm looking at the Sistine Chapel as a person of faith. But as I was reading your book, I was reminded of an earlier experience I had the first time I went to Rome. I think I was 10 or 11, and my parents were taking me on, one of those, month-long tours of Europe, right? If it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium kind of thing, right?
Yes.
We got to Rome, and I think we stayed for 2 or 3 days. And of course, and I think this was in 1970, so I think this is before they restored the Sistine
Yes.
Chapel. So I do seem to remember it being darker than this time when I saw it last. But anyway, so we walked in and we went to the Sistine Chapel, and I was just gobsmacked. And I had been raised secular. I suppose I would qualify at that time also as culturally Christian, but you know, Christmas was for presents and Easter was for chocolate, right? It was only much later that I found out that I had a great grandfather who had been a minister, but that had died down thoroughly by the time I was being raised. So, you know, what little I knew about Christianity was from television, which is a terrible way to learn about Christianity. Right. So I walked in and I was just gobsmacked, and I forced my parents to take us back a second time before we left Rome.
Well, that's interesting. Do you remember what it was that actually kind of caught your attention or
You know,
got off with you?
what I remember most clearly was the Last Judgment. I remember thinking that was incredibly powerful and scary, like really scary, but
It's very
fascinating.
scary, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I insisted that we go back twice, and I certainly was not a Christian in a, you know, meaningful sense back then. So I get where you're coming from. That room has a power, right?
Yes,
It has
it
a power
certainly
that you can
does.
feel even if you don't understand what you're looking at.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I mean, I did a write about taking my son there when he was little, partly because I wanted to see would it have an effect, because we've been in other churches where I could see that he was affected by the environment and interested. And he was going to an Italian school, and his teacher was Catholic. And, you know, she talked about Catholic stories, and he often recognized what was being depicted in a fresco before I would, or I wouldn't even know. He's the one who would tell me as a small child. But when we were in there, he was just overwhelmed, and it was really hot, and he wanted ice cream. And that was, we couldn't get him off that. So,
Priorities, mom, priorities,
yes,
right? Now,
exactly.
early on, one of the images which you really get taken with, and you describe it in some detail your reactions to, is a surprising image. I mean, it's surprising that it's on the ceiling at all, and it's surprising, I think, that this is the one that sort of started to open up the Sistine Chapel to you. And that's the image that Michelangelo paints at the far end of the chapel, of people who are about to be imminently drowned by the flood, coming up to what little land they can find for shelter and refuge. Can you just maybe, since this is an audio podcast, can you describe that picture for a minute and then
Yeah. And the thing that kind of struck me was you do see these people coming out of the water, and they look really despondent and frightened. And you see the ark in the distance, and you see that people are coming up out of the water, they're reaching land, they're carrying each other, they're carrying objects, they're not clothed for the most part. And it's a very strange image. And I kept thinking that these are the people who survived the flood. But of course, you know, that's, and I think he almost wanted you to have a bit of confusion about it, because they don't survive the flood. The ark is sailing away. That's why it's so small. It's in the distance, it's going away. And you realize that these people are going to die. And I just found it so powerful, because when I read that part in the King James Version, you know, it's also a very powerfully written passage. But you realize there's a lot of I mean, it seems sort of terrible and seems confusing. And he himself, Michelangelo, seems to have this kind of sympathy for these people. And he isn't just kind of saying, okay, God said that's it for you, and so you must have deserved it, and off you go. He seems to wonder why, and why did this happen, and what's wrong with these people? Like, what happened? Why should this be happening to them? And so his sympathy makes, suddenly, when you look at it, you start to have some sympathy for them as well. And you wonder why some were chosen, why some were not chosen, and why did he choose to depict these people instead of the ones who are going to survive? Why did he choose to depict the people who are condemned? And of course, it's not a question with an answer, but to sit there under it and to think about that is, to me, made me think about all the things that happen in your own life that you can't control, that you don't understand, you feel like you're being punished for something, you don't know what's going on in the world. just even just mortality itself, that sense that we all have to die at some point. And what does that mean for us? What does it mean for the life we have left? What does it mean after we die? You know, these are all these things seem to be kind of mixed into this image somehow, where you see the water and you see this grayness of everything that's all bleached of color, and it's all there's just this very, very faint horizon line where otherwise it looks like it's nothing but water, but you can't tell the sky from the water, and that almost becomes like a terrifying thing. It's not a terrifying, it's not like you're seeing fire and hell or anything. You're actually just seeing this kind of blankness. But having the chance to sit in the room after looking at all the colorful depictions of everything else in that room, including the paintings that are not done by Michelangelo, and then I became kind of overwhelmed by this little gray patch in the ceiling. But it did seem very meaningful to me, and it seemed to me like the first time that I could kind of say, oh, okay, I think this whole thing has more to say to me than I might have realized. And it's about art. It has things to say to me that are about art, but it has things to say to me also about the meaning of my own life as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting image because you're right. Michelangelo's sympathies are clearly with these people who are basically being killed by God. Like, that's the story, right? God gets fed up with how corrupt human beings have become and decides to just wipe them out and start over. And, you know, and theologians make the case that, you know, first of all, we don't have to take this story literally to begin with. There's no geological evidence that shows that this ever happened. So this is probably more a Jewish take on biblical, or rather a Jewish take on flood myths, which were common all through that part of the world. So they had to tell this story somehow. So they told it as a story where God is frustrated with a corrupt humanity, which has been corrupted from fallen by fallen angels, if you follow the logic of the biblical story, right? So it's not humanity's fault, but humanity, this part of humanity, most parts of humanity, have chosen to allow themselves to be corrupted, and God doesn't know how to restart short of just, you know, turning the computer off and turning it back on, basically, by doing a flood. But Michelangelo doesn't present these people looking as though they're a bunch of serial killers.
No, that's the thing. They just look like human beings, and they just look forlorn, I guess, and they are. They look, you know, like they're alone now, and that's a state you don't want to be in. I suppose that's partly why you look at it and it gives you a bit of a chill to see it
Yeah,
depicted in the
and as you say in the book, they don't know why they're gonna die.
way. Yes, they don't know. And
Right.
this is one of the things I like about Michelangelo, I think, is that he's not dogmatic, you know, in the painting. It's there's no you look at it for, looking for answers, you're not going to find any answers. It's all questions, and it's all just about searching. And that's, to me, the most important thing that you can do is just keep asking the questions again and again. And that's maybe where I first had that sense that it was so open, that it wasn't, I'm not looking at something where there's a very defined interpretation here. I could probably spend the rest of my life looking at it and not ever feel like I've got it. You know, you grasp hold of parts of it and then some other part gives away. And
Well, that's right, and I must admit that this time around, when I went with a thorough sense of the Bible in my head, and I looked up at the ceiling, and what I saw was all the non-biblical bits which Michelangelo had put in there. You know, we could talk about the famous image of Adam reaching out his finger to be touched by God, right?
Yes.
You know, first of all, that's not how Adam is created in the Bible, right? Adam is formed out of, you know,
Out
dirt,
of
out of
play,
mud,
right?
clay, yeah, right? And yet Michelangelo paints this sort of beautiful, naked, languid Adam. He's alive. You know, he obviously has breath and consciousness, and yet he's got his finger limpidly sort of put out, waiting for something extra to come from God. Is rushing towards him, right? And it begs the question, what is that extra thing?
That
Because
spark
he looks
for
just
something.
as human as all the humans who were trying to flee the flood.
But he looks slightly unanimated. And that's, I suppose, maybe we put ourselves in that position as well. And you say he's waiting, he can only really come to full life. His full life can only be experienced by being touched by God. And that's, I don't know, maybe that is what we're supposed to do, is identify in a way with Adam and feel that way ourselves. But it is a thrilling, I mean, it's such a hard piece to look at because you've seen it so much. But once you actually take it apart and look at it, even just the detail of the hands, the hand of Adam that's just sort of hanging there, and then this forceful God that's kind of coming with his hand outstretched. It's so powerful. And then when I was reading about it and discovered that some people didn't recognize that that was God and didn't understand what that was, is very interesting, because you think, okay, so he created an image that we all now see as a cliche, which is pretty successful then, But it is
Yeah.
hard to then break it down as someone who's seen it a lot and seen it, and I see it constantly. I'm so aware of it being used as a joke often in different contexts. And even in ads, you see it in advertisements all over Rome on billboards, used in different ways. And when you actually see it and have a chance to really look at it, you realize it's an extraordinary image in itself.
And yet, because and maybe one of the reasons it's so memorable is because it doesn't depict what the Bible describes.
Yes,
Right? You're not
and I
being.
didn't understand that until later, until reading that and realizing, oh yes, I mean, I knew that Adam was supposed to be made out of clay, but I thought, is there another version of this? No, that's his version.
Yeah, that's right. He made his version, which takes a
Yes.
lot of, And he's, how old is he when he does this? 24?
Gosh, he was in his 30s, like, when he was
30s?
doing that. Yes. And it's also arrogant as well, when you think about it. And he did see himself. People called him Divine Michelangelo, and he did see himself as quite something. And that fact that he creates the image of God creating the world in the same position that he had to take to create the Sistine Chapel, that's it. It's wonderful and beautiful, but it's not shy. It's quite, he certainly believes that he's doing something, I don't know what he has said as important, but he's doing something very important as well, which, maybe later he felt he shouldn't have been so arrogant about it. But at the same time, I sometimes think with artists generally, we've all met egotistical artists, but it takes a certain amount of ego for sure to actually go in and decide, I'm going to show you something from inside me and that I think is important for humanity. And that's what he's doing. So I think you can't be a wallflower if you're going to do that.
Indeed. And I mean, and it's funny too, in the area where God is creating the sun and the moon and the stars, you see God looking very, very determined and in charge, but you also see God's backside,
Yes, isn't
the
that
full
funny?
buttock shot of God. It's like, wow, really?
I was there once when there was a school group there, and I thought the teachers did something nice, which was they gave the kids a list, like, find these things, find the ark, find. So it's just a way for them to actually be able to look at the ceiling and locate things. But one of them, they were all howling over it, was find God's bum. And, I mean, that was, I think, the last thing on the list. And they're just, killing themselves laughing over that. But it's there.
But that speaks to something which Michelangelo brings to Christian art, which hadn't been there as clearly as before. He obviously loves the human body.
Yes. You see all the muscles that he, and they're not necessarily anatomically totally right. Well, they are, but they're also his, like, it's always his interpretation. If you just see a picture, a muscular body that's painted by Michelangelo, no one has to tell you that that was Michelangelo who did it. You see the kind of weird lumpiness about it that is also beautiful. Although apparently it was Leonardo who said that his Michelangelo's people looked like sacks of walnuts, which, in a way, yes, I can kind of see it. Yes,
People can be
but
lumpy. It happens.
no, and there, but there's a beautiful in Florence. There's the beautiful a wooden crucifix that's in in Santo Spirito, in the Basilica di Santo Spirito, and it's an early sculpture that Michelangelo did, and it was thought to have been a thank you gift to the hospital because they let him look at cadavers. And so he creates this very young, oh, like Christ almost looks like a young boy. And it's beautifully done. It's such a beautiful thing, but it's also very, very anatomically correct, all the muscles and everything. So that it's kind of heartbreaking as well, because it's this, thin person being suffering like that. But it's a really beautiful thing. But you really see that, okay, he was paying attention to all to the body very, very, very early on.
And that comes across loud and clear in the final judgment, where virtually everybody is naked. And even Christ is naked except for this one strip of cloth, which covers his midsection. And that too is revolutionary. Like, you've walked through the Vatican museums many times, so you've had to go through the rooms that have medieval art, right? And medieval depictions of God and Christ, they're always fully dressed. Right? I mean, even Christ on the cross sometimes is shown with wearing a sort of a tunic of kinds, or sometimes a skirt. Like, it takes a long time before we get to the Renaissance and they strip him down just to a loincloth. But the idea that, you could depict divine figures as naked is something which was alien to Christianity in the Middle Ages, but was of course completely commonplace to the Romans and the Greeks. They depicted their gods naked all the time, and Michelangelo was studying their art, right? He was studying the statues they were digging out of the ruins of Rome and getting his ideas, right? So he takes this
So
very
that the
pagan idea and
tradition.
he puts it right up there on the top ceiling of, this very Christian place.
And it was very controversial as well. All of that nudity, it did upset a lot of people. And there was one pope who actually wanted to paint it over, but he died. Thank goodness. You think about that sometimes. You think if he had lived and painted it over, man, well, we wouldn't be having this conversation for sure.
The other human figures which you talk about, which you have great admiration for, are the figures who are the prophets, as well as the genealogy of Christ, right? Can you talk a little bit about why you find those figures so interesting?
Well, the ancestors are not, they're often described as being not that well painted. They're a little bit, there's almost something a bit fuzzy about them. And there's a lot of speculation that he may have done basic outlines, but his apprentices actually painted those parts. And also, I found it interesting that he includes pictures of women in the in there when the women are not listed, of course, as the ancestors, but they're there, they had to be, so he shows them as well.
Yeah, and one of the other things which is interesting is that many of them look really bored.
They do, don't they? Yes, they look like they're just kind of waiting. And
Yeah, and
maybe that's it.
I've read some people say that, he painted them that way because they are waiting for the Messiah to come. And what's really funny when you're actually in the Sistine Chapel is that you'd think that everybody who has made it through the long hallways and the long wait, it's kind of like going through IKEA, right? You have to see everything else before you get to the thing you wanted. You get to the Sistine Chapel, you'd think that everybody on the ground would be really excited, but that's not the case. There's people who have been dragged there by their families or the tour or whatever who don't want to be there. And they're bored on the ground. And it's so funny that in this, really, really important painting on the ceiling, Michelangelo has painted bored people. There's
He's
this
brought
weird
it in
mirroring
as a
happening.
It's a necessary component of the whole thing, the waiting. There, yes, it is. I've always found it fascinating to look at the people as well as when you're in this in the chapel and to look at where other people are looking and what they're trying to see and to note the ones who look like, oh, I just want to get out of here and I'm already exhausted. And you think, they probably spent months planning their visit and then they finally get inside and they can't really quite do it. I do feel like you have to book a few visits to get the sense of what you're really looking at. So I have sympathy for anybody going through there on your first visit. I have a good friend who she told me about her son when her son was 12. They were visiting with family, And they had built up the Sistine Chapel so that when he got inside and he was exhausted from it all, and they'd been touring many places, he had a meltdown inside and started yelling, "This place is overrated." But I actually visited the Sistine Chapel with that boy. He's an adult now, and he didn't find it overrated. He was much more engaged by it as an adult. But yes.
So the in some ways the climax of the Sistine Chapel isn't on the ceiling, it's on the altar wall where Michelangelo's painted the Final Judgment. You in your book do a really good job of sort of explaining, he did that in the 30s, I guess, right? And after the Reformation of 1517,
Yes.
that starts, right? So the world has changed quite a lot by the time he gets to painting the Final Judgment, the Christ standing there, pronouncing judgment over those who will be living in bliss for the rest of eternity and those who definitely won't. What sorts of things had happened in real life, do you think, that colored the way he painted that?
In Rome, they were somewhat oblivious to what was going on. They were trying all of these schemes to raise money for many things, but artworks were, eating up a lot of cash, and they were sending out people to collect money on indulgences, so you could bypass purgatory a little faster. Or I found that so fascinating, the whole idea of the sale of indulgences. And this is something my mother just used to rail on about all the time, and I never really quite understood until I read about it in more detail in this time. And you realize it was an outrageous scheme to be raising money by telling people it doesn't really matter what you do or what kind of life you lead, you just buy a ticket essentially, and it will go towards rebuilding the new St. Peter's, or it will go towards creating this great art that Michelangelo and the others are making. And Michelangelo is kind of blithely going along. I mean, he's always having trouble apparently getting his money out of the Pope, but nonetheless, he's still living within that world and not recognizing the effect that this is having on the larger world of Christianity until Martin Luther comes along and says, "No, this is wrong," and creates quite a fuss. And then, of course, there is the sack of Rome that happens in 1527. I always get dates wrong, 1527. So that, and Michelangelo was not in Rome at the time, but of course he saw the terror that this inflicted, and the damage that it inflicted, and the charges that Luther was making, they landed, I think, with him. Like, he did start to see it and start to realize that this was wrong, that this was not how the leader of the church should be behaving, that the people were at risk, people's souls were at risk, all of this was at risk. And perhaps he had been too arrogant in accepting these commissions and seeing himself in this way and not recognizing the larger world that this is inhabiting. And it was brutal, it was murderous. I mean, it's not like there was one good side and one bad side, it was all pretty awful, but it would have been pretty shocking to go through it. So you can see that he's a changed person by the time that he comes to paint the Last Judgment, and he's afraid. I think he's afraid himself. And so the reason that the dark parts of that fresco, the parts that depict what happens to those who are not saved, they are scary and they are very detailed. And I think it's because he was worried for himself. Maybe he had not been the Christian that he should have been. Not as, even though, he may have prayed a lot, he may have had this faith and held this belief, but he may not have acted in the way deeply that he should have been acting. And so he paints himself as the flayed skin of, well, they think Saint Bartholomew essentially, but it has Michelangelo's face, and it's such a gruesome image. It's just awful. And to think that that's the image that he left of himself in the Sistine Chapel is just, the kind of self-punishment that is involved in depicting yourself that way, I think, is says quite a lot. But to realize that history and to realize that this was a turning point in not just in Christianity, but in world history, and that it happens between the painting of the ceiling and the painting of the altar wall. And so you've got these two worlds are preserved. So you have the world of Renaissance Christianity that we don't really have in the same way anymore, depicted on the ceiling. And then you have this rather frightened version on the wall that is very raw and very, reacting to very recent events that we're still living with now. So that to me was really amazing and fascinating to realize that that's what those dates represented, that that history was right there, and quite and a reaction of one person is right there. It's quite visible.
So, what about you and the Sistine Chapel now? You said you're dividing your time between Canada and Italy. Do you still go back to the Sistine Chapel after having thought about it and written about it so much now?
I have come back a couple of times since, and but it's part, I've been going back with other people, whereas I used to always go by myself. And I do prefer going alone just because it, you can take as much time or as little as you want, or stand and stare at one thing without having to explain yourself. And also because if you're with other people, you tend to talk. It's just inevitable, so you tend to talk. So I'd like to go back. And then the other problem is that we, although we are dividing our time between Canada and Italy, we're living in a little house in Umbria now. So we've left Rome. We lived in Rome for 22 years. And then we had a little house that we bought in the countryside to fix up and to maintain a foothold in the country. And so that's what that is. But it's about an hour outside of Rome. So I do, there's a nice train connection and everything, but I do find that every time I go, I have a list of things I have to do. And now I'm realizing I have to put the Sistine Chapel on the list because I haven't been going, and I really feel almost sad about it because I feel like my connection to it is very strong, but I feel like it's being stretched because of not being able to just go easily. And there are new challenges as well. Before it used to be that you lined up and bought a ticket, and that was difficult enough. And then they created an online system which helped. But now, of course, with everything, there are bots that buy the tickets up and scalpers that sell the tickets now. So it's become even harder to get it to, not impossible, but it's become even harder to get tickets. So I have to think about all of that and plan it. But I would like to, I think I need to go maybe at least once a year. Whereas before I would go every few months. Now I think I can manage once a year. So it's been almost a year since I've been, so I have to go this fall.
Well, hopefully people who have heard our discussion will be put the Sistine Chapel on their list when they go to Rome. And I encourage you also just to take a look at pictures of the Sistine Chapel and just, drink them in. It's not the same as being in the room, but it is a spectacular testament to a Christian cosmos made into one room. You kind of feel like you walked into a universe when you go to the Sistine Chapel.
That's a good way to describe it. Yes, very much so.
And there aren't too many things which seem so whole and coherent in our lives anymore. So it's a nice kind of oasis,
Yes,
for
definitely it
Christian,
is.
yeah, for Christians and non-Christians alike. So.
Yes. Yeah, it's where the convergence of Christianity and art, I think that's the apex of it right there. It's really where the two feelings come together beautifully.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your journey to the Sistine Chapel over and over again and how it's affected your life. Your book is a lovely read and it's not too long, folks, so I encourage you to read it and I wish you
Oh,
all
and
the
it has
best.
pictures.
And it has lots of beautiful pictures in it, yeah. So I wish you all the best, Jeannie, going forward and living back in Canada now as well as in Rome. And thank you
Yes,
for the
thank
gift of
you.
this book. Thanks for listening. This has been the Rooster Crows Podcast. We're produced by Lawrence Park Community Church, which is located in Toronto, Canada. We're a member of the United Church of Canada, a progressive Christian denomination. If you'd like to learn more about our particular church, please visit our website at www.lawrenceparkchurch.ca.